Hello, we'd like to get started if everybody could sit down, please. Are we functioning? We're waiting on computer technology for this. All right, well then we're going to get started. I'm Bill Drake from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and this is the panel on the big picture. We've been talking a lot about the technological aspects and competition and registrations and so on, but now what we want to do is kind of pull back from some of those particular issues to think about this in a broader context and begin to understand how ICANN is going to function in the future in the context of the larger nexus of relationships that are going to provide order in the global internet environment. And there are a lot of big outstanding questions here, obviously, as to the status of ICANN and whether or not ICANN needs to be reformed, can be reformed, should be replaced with some other mechanism, so on. And if it is replaced, or were it to be abolished even, as some people would argue it should be, what would that mean in terms of the role of governments and other players? So we want to try and think about what is really the best path forward for the internet, and also, I guess, what is politically sustainable given the increasing interest of governments around the world in these issues, which I think unfortunately cannot be denied. I think we also want to start to think about some of the larger sets of relationships that are going to impact internet governance broadly defined. So we tend not to talk about those in meetings like this. But of course, the kinds of issues that are involved with ICANN are not the only issues out there that are going to impact how the internet is organized on a global basis. We're seeing in a wide variety of cases, both with regard to the underlying infrastructure and with regard to the transactions conducted over that infrastructure, electronic commerce, communication, and so on, that a variety of different players in the private sector and especially in government are increasingly showing a lot of interest in playing a role in setting rules, setting norms, establishing institutions that are going to impact the way the internet functions in the future. I think in particular, from my own standpoint, something to keep an eye on in this regard is the growing role of the World Trade Organization, which I think a lot of people probably don't pay attention to, but there are proposals for the WTO in the next round of multilateral trade negotiations, the millennium round, starts next year, to adopt rules that would directly impact ICANN and registrations. So I think there's a larger set of issues then that have to be thought about in terms of how the global internet is going to be organized and what can be done with it on a worldwide basis, and what is going to be the balance of authority and involvement on the part of different kinds of stakeholders, both governmental, private sector, non-commercial, and so on. Try and start to think about some of these big picture issues. We have an illustrious panel, so illustrious in fact that I think I will skip going through the biographies. You can always look at the information that's in the packet, and I will simply introduce them briefly. We will lead off with Tony Rutkowski, who is now running the Center for Next Generation Internet, is that what it is? Followed by Michael Fumkin from the University of Miami, Milton Mueller from Syracuse University, and Julie Cohn couldn't be here, alas, but I managed to convince Esther at the last second to please be on the panel to provide another perspective so that this didn't end up into a sort of one-sided dumping on ICANN event. So, while, to be fair to her, she's speaking impromptu, the other three have well-organized, structured presentations and PowerPoints and wonderful displays and things like that. So, I appreciate her willingness to jump in here at the last second. I'm going to try and get people to stick close to 12 minutes each or so that we can end something close to on time and still have time for Q&A. So, with that, let's turn first to Tony Rutkowski.
Although this will work temporarily, okay? Very pleased to be here, and the presentation, by the way, is over here on paper. It'll also probably be on the WIA site, and I suspect all this will be put up on other sites as well. My presentation is solely my own views. Let's see if we can. And that's me and the NGI Associates and one of about a dozen internet identities. These things end up being sort of internet persona, almost like to call these sort of domain names or the new cyber flows. I want to make several points. Three is another time. One that ICANN GAC, and I always hyphenize this. People don't realize that the GAC's there. You can sort of see it on the organizational chart. It is a significant component, actually, organizationally, and holds itself out to be semi-autonomous. So they have to be considered in conjunction with each other. But it's basically what I call a two-person function needlessly exploded into a hopelessly complex organizational labyrinth. And it's also a European regulatory model. And it's also, from a public policy perspective, I think it's basically untenable. And I'll go a little bit into each one of these. I also wanted to take some time and enumerate why I believe its formation and its actions thus far have been what I characterize as unlawful and contrary to longstanding policy. And that any of the several viable alternatives are really more appropriate and better choices. What was kind of amusing, my old friend Bill Drake, when I sort of read and been plugged into a lot of this over the last year, began to iterate what went on. He kept on saying, I don't believe this, I don't believe this, I don't believe this. Because if you existed in the public policy world over a period of years, or for that matter, in the sort of the legal telecoms world, there's just so many bells and whistles that Nikki Berry likes to say that goes off. It's pretty amazing. This is before ICANN GAC. This was the organization. It was John Postel. And a largely hidden but person, but an absolutely marvelous person who did most of the work, was Joyce Reynolds. And the only real functions that are necessary to perform here are really threefold. Which others have, I think, largely talked about, but let me talk about it in terms of organizational people functions. It's to keep a small database of miscellaneous protocol values you don't see or care about. That's about a half-person function. It's to facilitate as required and coordinate amongst existing IP regional registries. That's about a quarter function. I mean, most people don't realize that the IP addresses are actually administered by regional organizations. You know, the only sort of higher level function that's needed is some coordination amongst them, which was about a quarter of John's time or less. And then the third function is decide as required what additions or changes that may be the legacy DNS root zone server, which is also basically a very minimalist function. And I wanted to point out, actually, for those who reside in the telecom world, that even in the telecom world, for the entire global telecommunications system, these functions are actually no more than two people in Geneva in the ICUP. So that comparable functions organizationally manifested in other settings are very minimalist functions. So what happened? This sort of grew like topsy over the last year. And we have basically these two functions. It's a sort of mammoth organization. I'm not going to go into details. But this probably, historically, takes the cake for the most complex organization for functional density that's been created in this field in the last century. Each one of these entities is basically autonomous, with its own charter, its own set of provisions, rules, databases. Each one of those little cylinders is a place autonomously where information is located. And in order to even begin to sort of comprehend what's going on, much less participate effectively, requires enormous resources to basically constantly engage in all this stuff. Even at the lower level down, several of those boxes go down to subsidiary levels that have their own levels of complexity, their own processes and people and functions and charters. By the way, the originals of these things are on the WIA.org site. And all the underlying stuff in the boxes are HTML links. You can actually get to this stuff and see the source information. Why do I say ICANN-GAC is a European regulatory model?
Well, mainly because the European Union representative 2 years ago at the CILP meeting in Washington said this is what he wanted, and he spelled it out. And what he spelled out is exactly what ICANN-GAC is. It's a, in the European self-governance model, it's governance makes the policies, industry implements them. And you can go to the CILP site and actually see that. You can go to the EU documents and you can see how they insisted this be put in place. It was really negotiated by the U.S. administration. I literally saw the provisions being put in the as part of the ICANN Charter articles drafting process to the European Union insist that they be put in to effect this particular arrangement. In that arrangement, ICANN is required to submit all substantive actions in advance to GAC for its review and findings, including the GAC's determination of relevant law and policy. And another typical sort of European strategy, and I say this because, I mean, you can read my history, I've seen this in the ICU, I've seen it in the U.S. government over the last 30 years, is basically what I call forced regionalization, and as a strategy that dilutes the sort of the force and effect of U.S. industry in the particular technology arena, whether it's the internet or satellite systems or any other kind of technologies. And it also basically, and I think this is particularly important from a legal public policy standpoint, is it deletes U.S. network law and policy values, which are heavily individual oriented. And those values largely are not shared most other places in the world. From a public policy perspective, the ICANN-GAC is really a government-supported corporation with a monopoly franchise to exercise potentially unlimited regulatory authority over the entire internet. It's insulated from accountability by organizational shells. And that's why you have actually a lot of this complexity, because the general counsel and some of the staff associated with ICANN believed it had to be sort of just totally insulated from as much as possible from litigation. And so this incredibly complex structure was effective. The other thing that's really kind of fascinating in terms of organizations, and I don't know of any equivalent, is that every constituency is actually wired into the organizational structure. And this, I argue, maximizes contention and conflict of interest, because literally everyone in the structure has a kind of a conflict of interest. It's also very easily captured, and indeed has been. You can sort of go back to the GCLB MOU and see all the players that were involved basically in that faction, and that faction basically largely controls ICANN today. It's also a labyrinthine complexity that precludes effective participation and promotes control by insiders. And you have that kind of an organization. It's just hopelessly complex for anyone to effectively deal with. What it ends up doing is meaning it results in the staff and people on the board actually enjoying enormous powers, much more so than they would otherwise have. And I think that was a very significant concern, particularly because this has been a particularly transparent organization. And there's minimal to no due process, transparency, reservations or other safeguards that are typically built in a domestic and international regulatory system. If sort of we get into the end of a sort of what-if scenario, if somehow this goes to a more formal governmental process, will we be better off or worse off? The last 6 months have been what I call a litany of abusive and unlawful actions, actually not only on ICANN's part, in GAC's part, the Department of Commerce's part. Department of Commerce itself is really acting without authority on this. It's pursuing a wholly inappropriate role. Their role is not to do this. And if you take the time to sort of read their charter or read the documents that created Department of Commerce, like the Executive Order 12046, it sets up function and all kinds of safeguards, and those have basically been bypassed here. And lastly, but perhaps most importantly, this is really sort of fundamentally contrary to the computer cube GATT legal and telecommunications information policy setting that have existed the last 20 years that have literally nurtured and enabled the Internet to come into existence and scale as it has. On the GATT side, it really is created an intergovernmental body in the form of, GATT represents the creation of an intergovernmental body. And it's worth emphasizing that one of the first things it did was to say that the people present in part of it are not merely people who happen to be in the government and speaking their view. They actually, as an almost first order of business, said that the members are sovereign states themselves, and they constituted themselves, in fact, as an intergovernmental body, and they accredit representatives from sovereigns, and they behave as an intergovernmental body. And again, don't take my word for it. Go read the source material. Go listen to the chairman of the GATT speak and describe what's being done. Lastly, ICANN itself is really a government corporation in disguise. I mean, it would not exist but for acting through the Department of Commerce. It acted as a private regulatory agency. Many of the things it's done over the last 6 months are regulation at a level of granularity and force and effect that are greater than even the FCC Common Carrier Bureau would have in treatment of common carriers in the telecom industry. It provides very minimal due process. It violates its own provisions with impunity. It displays public prejudices. And it disenfranchises individuals and users. And lastly, although it's a relatively trivial point, it's really not a 501c3, it's at least a C2. That doesn't enjoy that tax status either. And I think a lot of the other people on the panel will go to these points and certainly be a subject of discussion afterwards. Some of this was actually justified, I think, intellectually by the people involved, by the devil made me do it. In this case, it was the monopoly. And the monopoly was this concept that somehow all of this, and this is all basically on record, because the network solutions was somehow the evil empire behind all of this and had to be attacked. Well, the reality is, of course, as I mentioned yesterday, that registrar-registry competition was set in place 2 years ago. There are 250 top-level domains. There is certainly and potentially almost infinite number of additional ones. And even within the competing registers arena now, we're standing at 10 or 12, heading towards about 80 over the next couple of months. So there's this massive amounts of competition now. And certainly registrars.com was represented here yesterday. In closing, I wanted to point out several things, suggesting that really the alternatives are more appropriate and much better choices. And sort of preface-sizing this, one of my passions over the last 30 years is to sort of find out how organizations happen, what their life cycle was, where ideas happened. And I spent a lot of fun time at the FCC archives and ITU archives. The plain fact of the matter is you don't see them because they're like dead bodies lying there, but there are actually incredible institutional failures that were started by administrations over the years that failed, in some cases spectacularly, in some cases silently. And indeed, one of the mirror ones is actually the OSI system, which failed and was superseded basically by the Internet. The Internet institutions, I also point out that it's common to describe as things happening on the Internet very quickly at Internet speed. Well, ironically, I think we have an example of how institutions and institutional arrangements can also go wrong at Internet speed. And that should be really a subject of concern. What happens if ICANN ceases to exist? That's been a subject, I think, of some discussion already yesterday and today. I think there's actually a significant consensus that nothing functionally adverse will occur. ICANN doesn't run anything, so nothing actually will happen. Competition continues through existing agreements and antitrust laws. And the thing I like to point out is who manages competition for everything else in the industry? And there is a team out there. So one has to ask why here? I mean, why aren't the antitrust laws and contractual arrangements aren't sufficient for everything else? Why aren't they sufficient here? And there's also some possible attempts by other governments to force institutional alternatives. But again, this is nothing new. The governments of the world tried to actually create an OSI version of the Internet for 20 years and actually include the provisions and treaties and standards. And in fact, many of you probably have been around this field long enough to have known the Internet as being described as the de jure system, I mean the de facto system. There was a whole other sort of set of arrangements for the de jure system. And it failed. So, I mean, governments really, in this particular arena, have limited force and effect. Or to the extent they do, they can be routed around fairly easily. There will be alternatives appearing, DNS alternatives, and those were discussed by the previous panels. There are also other organizations that could pick up pieces of this. How many of you know NANOG? I mean, NANOG coordinates most of the rest of the operations in the Internet. One has to ask, why didn't they pick this up, or why couldn't they pick it up, to the extent coordination is needed? And the NA is North American, but there's no reason why something like NANOG couldn't be expanded, or its equivalent, regional equivalent couldn't simply join together to do this. So the bottom line is there are other institutional mechanisms and institutions that actually function in the Internet operational sphere out there. And in closing, if ICANN manages to survive, I argue it's a lightning rod for endless mischief. And as a pundit, I would suggest that, I don't know, maybe in the sort of great scheme of things, that itself has some value. Everyone who wants to play King of the Hill for the Internet can basically go to ICANN and play on that game, and the rest of the Internet can go on. Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is Michael Frimkin. I'm from the University of Miami School of Law, and I'm going to talk incredibly fast to try to make the 12-minute guidelines. I've given you a provocative title, it's bait and switch.
Okay.
Which button is the mouse?
Oh, the mouse.
Mike, what's up? There are two stories that I think need to be kept side by side. About the ICANN relationship, the big picture and the governance question. The first is a story that I hear a lot. I'm going to tell you why I don't quite believe it. It's a classic story, the story of ICANN sitting at the choke point on the Internet, the domain name system being a potential mechanism for leverage and control over various vital things that we've begun to take for granted or wish to take for granted, being free and relatively unregulated, the possibility of levying quote-unquote taxes, putting in content control, and all the rest of it. And then I'm going to try to tell you what I think is this week the real story, which is a story of chaos and autocracy. I'm going to try to tell you that the second story is not only a problem in its own right, but the fact that it exists makes it impossible to disprove convincingly the first story, and that's a lot of our problem. All right, that study was just outlined. I know some of you have been here yesterday, well, I've heard some of this before, so I'll go real fast. What is the sort of choke point story? It has a certain surface plausibility, right? If your TLD is not in the legacy route, you are, as a tactical matter, invisible to most people who use the Internet in the most basic vanilla way. Yes, there are alternate routes. Yes, we can move around. Yes, things can happen. Yes, the world can change very fast. But as we stand and sit here today, right now, this is not being in the legacy route has real consequences for your ability to interact with the users you're trying to reach. This is because of network effects, this is because of user inertia, this is because of the architect, the commonly used product of Microsoft, getting in and changing the DNS stuff is kind of fiddly. I like to think I know what I'm doing. It took me more than 5 minutes, which annoys me. Now, all this can and probably will change someday, but if I knew when that was, I would be a very rich man. Therefore, in the world that we live in right now, before things change, whoever it is who sits at the control of the legacy rule at least arguably has some very important slowdown powers. Right? They can, contractually, through private law, impose various conditions on people who want access to the resources, especially who want into the legacy rule, who want into the registration services. They can put terms in contracts which are not subject to governmental controls because it's a private law contract. Just like your employer can do things to you, if it's a private employer, but the government can't do to you, like sit your desk without a warrant, so too can private contracts do all sorts of things. That's part of freedom. You give people the power to contract and do things that you don't let the government do. And here's a case where you get the flip side of it. You know, nobody forces you to have a domain name. Nobody puts a gun to your head and says, you must have a domain name. And therefore, as far as the formal legal system is concerned, if people want to put in conditions for their provision to you of that private service, up to a very high point, right? You can't sell your first born child in slavery, but up to a very high point, there's a really awful lot they can do, and the law will allow that because it's a free, privately consented transaction. So the idea is, the fear is, that the people who control that valuable resource, to access that valuable resource, that service, the default service, will stick in conditions that will make people miserable and uncomfortable and damage the general well-being. And examples of this are certain classes of people might sign up to be seen, rules of good behavior. You know, anti-cyber squatting is one we're working on right now at the ICANN level, but why not an anti-spam rule? If you're a domain that's commonly hosting spammers, maybe we've got to pull you out. Or privacy rules. Like I've argued that there's something wrong with the visibility rules. Well, yeah, maybe other privacy rules get built into this too. And that's something a lot of people might agree on. The world might be a better place with this privacy rule at some time. One can imagine arguments being made for the leverage of this valuable contractual power. And, of course, this week in particular, this month in particular, in light of the recent meetings in Germany, one has to ask, you know, could this theoretically be leveraged for content controls and mandatory filtering and other things like that? And I have to say that one can't unequivocally say that it would be impossible to try to use the system to push it in that direction. I'm not saying people are planning this. I'm just talking about what is conceivable. Well, this, of course, then raises the question, who is it who's actually in control? And my contention to you today is that at this moment, right now, as a practical brass tack, who's got the power? Question, ultimately, it's the U.S. Commerce Department, the U.S. government. The U.S. government has never done the magic waving of hands to say, we are getting out of this business and I can't assist me over. They've done a magic sort of nodding of the head and saying, we'd like to get out of it, we hope it'll be ICANN, we plan to do it, but they haven't actually done it. Now, I am alighting in this conversation to kind of limit all sorts of very interesting questions about legal authority for the reason they're not. That's a separate question. I'm just talking about raw power here. If the U.S. government announced tomorrow morning that it thought that ICANN was a mistake and it was going to do something else, a lot of people would follow. Even if the government didn't have the authority to make that announcement, even if the announcement was made on no basis at all, I think that's where the power is. So that at some very important level, this isn't a political issue. I put up here some of the other questions as well. There are issues about ownership of the data. There's all kinds of problems with that, even monopolist when it's dying. Right? Many, many things running around confusing the issues. But the basic fact is right now, ICANN is acting as if the Commerce Department is at least acquiescing, if not supporting in that, but nothing permanent has happened. And my political reading of CBU, which is not legal analysis, is that if Commerce changed its mind, that would be very significant. Well, now we've got ICANN. Right? ICANN is in the picture, and many people have called it the virgin birth. I've heard it called original sin. Right? All kinds of funny names. You know, ICANN gets created through this process you've all heard about, which is not the most, let's say, open and transparent selection process for board members in the history of man. And there it is. It's trying to make policy. It fundamentally held itself out to the community. And I'm talking here now about the perceptions and the atmospherics as trust us. We're going to do, you know, that has been a very good method of internet governance often. Lots of news networks works fundamentally on trust. As Hale says, list the group, lots of people list the group. Trust is, there's nothing wrong inherently with a trust-based system. so long as there's trust. I mean, that wasn't, you know, a student model to pick, but that was at the core of the initial setup. Trust us, you know, we're going to try to get this right, we'll come up with something, and let's get going. Certainly when it started, I was fully prepared to do that. Trouble is that as things go on, the sort of the lawyer genes start to reassert themselves. I think one of the big problems we've had in this ICANN thing is a clash of two cultures between the engineers and the lawyers. Now, I'm not an engineer, but I do seem to spend increasing parts of my life hanging around with them. And as far as I can tell, engineers, you know, it's a gross overgeneralization, but I've only got 4 minutes left. Engineers are kind of results-oriented guys. They're usually guys, I don't know why, but they're people, right? They ask, you know, if you're talking about shipbuilding, the engineering question is, does it float? Right? If you talk to a lawyer about shipbuilding, lawyers, we've all been to law school and learned about Justice Holmes' classical bad man, where you look at a rule system and say, how would somebody abuse this system? And you don't ask, does it float? You ask, how easily does it get out of control? Will it chop people's legs off? And at what wind does it sink? Right? I mean, all completely different questions that the engineers are concerned about, and usually they're using business people, paid lawyers, because there they are worrying about strange contingencies and business people just want to go off and make money. And another big difference is that lawyers are really focused on process. I teach a lot of process courses, and I tell my students that process is substance. I actually believe that. Process is critical. And lawyers, by professional socialization, and who knows, even by fee selection, are nasty, suspicious people. And it's no accident that constitutions tend to be written by lawyers, because it turns out that being a nasty, suspicious person is a great preparation for writing a constitution, which really matters when things go wrong. So you want to have that thinking about it. It's not the same kind of thinking as engineers tend to do. So here are the bad things that lawyers, you know, worry about. Some of the things I mentioned before, taxes and domain names and IP numbers. And these are different issues, by the way. Yeah, IP numbers aren't as visible, but in some ways, in the long term, they're probably more important. Conditions on these resources. And remember, some of these might be great rules. We might like some of these rules. We might not like others. And who we is in that sentence is different for different rules. The bottom line, though, is that when the trust dissolves, all you're left with is trust. When the trust dissolves, all you're left with is trust. And here we get to what I say is a really a lousy governance model. Now, you know, we all know how we got here, right? There's something in the internet tradition that is essentially suspicious of governments. Governments are bad. You know, they're full of rent seekers and special interests and some Congress people and uninformed voters, all these stereotypes. As somebody who's done a fair amount of local politics, actually my own impression of the average voter is somewhat higher than the stereotype of easy to believe, but that's just my own personal problem. Let me say this. Governments are the product of a very long evolution. They're the way they are for all kinds of reasons, and some of those are darn good reasons. The things that sometimes bug you about governments are not an accident. They're the result of an evolution. They're the response to real-life conditions. Governments have well-evolved rules on representation. The engineers ought to call that feedback control system. Right? They got real rules about notice, about voting. People have thought about this stuff. They've got rules about self-dealing, like data corruption. People can put in true data into the system. They've got rules about procedures, called protocols. They've got rules about external checks from outside, called illegal boundary conditions. You know, some of those things we like, you know, due process, even, you know, God forbid, lawsuits. There's a reason why we have all this sand in the gears. It's because we're afraid of the gears. The gears can chew you up. Now, I would submit to you that at some very fundamental level, the procedural flaws in the ICANN system are a design feature, because the people involved at some deep level are engineers and don't think enough about social process. Indeed, one of the ICANN officials who put in the New York Times is saying, with all due respect, we are less interested in complaints about process and more interested in doing real work and moving forward. So my point to you is that at this stage in the game, in the early stages of trying to create governance that isn't governmental and isn't anymore just based on trust, you don't have to have all the finality, process procedure is the real work at this stage. And let me tell you, like software, if any of you have ever tried to build a software suite or something, if you start with a bad architecture, you pay for it downstream. Only do you pay for it downstream. All of a sudden, it changes one thing here, it has consequences over there, the function calls are getting all messed up, the logic flow isn't right. That picture on that wall, Tony didn't do a good enough sales job for his own work. Let me tell you, that picture on that wall is one of the most significant, that's worth more than 1,000 years. That tells you an enormous amount about what's going on. It's an incredibly complex structure, and it has every sign of sort of a code base gone wild. The Byzantine structure is intimately related with ICANN's information crisis, which it has right now. You know, there are issues about its creation, which were never really resolved, issues about its funding, which have yet to be resolved. You know, getting money from interested parties doesn't really help much in terms of information. Even if nothing bad is happening, it creates worries which are difficult to disprove, and that goes to legitimacy. The issues about the rate of spending make people concerned. There's a terrible expectation outcome mismatch. Now, I'm not here to assign blame. I'm just describing people, rightly or wrongly, had one set, many people had one set of expectations about what was going to happen early. You do structural stuff first, then something. Maybe they were wrong. Maybe they were right. That's not what I'm here to tell you today. The point is, that was a real belief out there. And that belief wasn't met, rightly or wrongly. And that leads into the legitimation problem. You've got these representational structures that I believe are terribly flawed because they don't really need, you know, the belief of something needs to feel represented. And what's perhaps worst of all is this term consensus is being abused. And I got to tell you, at least tentatively, I've come to the view that we're in an area of policy, political decision-making, where consensus probably can't be achieved. And that's maybe not the end of the world. I mean, sometimes there are winners and sometimes there are losers, and sometimes it's just life can go on. You can't say in some areas, so long as there's a loser, we'll do nothing. And maybe some areas are less appropriate, there's some other areas where there aren't, and this might even be one of the ones where they're not. So I'm not one who says everything has to be consensus. But I will say that something really bad happens, legitimacy and honesty, when you claim consensus, when it's one of the situations where there are winners and losers. Sometimes you've got to be honest about the fact that somebody's, you know, losing out now. And be real about it. And some people will put up with that. I mean, I voted for a heck of a lot of losing candidates since I was 18 years old. And I've never once taken up arms against my country because I believe, you know, the system has some fundamental basic thing unrepresented. So I put up with the fact that I don't get my way. And you can create structures when people feel included, but don't put up with losing. Or at least, you know, most people just put up with losing. You know that? You just beat around sometimes. So what are the things, you know, what are the things that take away from that? Well, we've got incredible notice problems in the ICANN structure. I spend just about all my free time these days trying to keep up with what's going on in these groups. And I get lost. Looks like I missed a week at one point, and they substituted one document for another document. All of a sudden, we're using the registrar's draft or something instead of some other drafts. And, you know, where, you know, so when did that happen? Well, we had it posted for a week on the website. You didn't notice. I didn't. You know, it's a timing issue. Now, again, you know, notice it's time. It slows things down. It's down in the gears. Speaking of timing, oh, dear, I've only got about 2 minutes. I'll skip ahead here. I worry when I give a talk like this that the engineering, my engineering experience, here's another example of lawyers going on about rules. Well, rules have a purpose. And sometimes those purposes hurt. They make deciders jump through hoops they'd rather avoid. That's why they're there. To get in the way sometimes. That getting in the way can actually be a good thing. Internet participation in ICANN has not been, I think, everything I personally would have hoped it could be. As someone who's never able to make meetings because I can't cancel classes, I have a real sense, and maybe I'm wrong about this, that the people who turn up have a big advantage. In the last weeks, for example, I've seen messages go by who said, we made this deal at the meeting, and now it's not being... You know, it wasn't formalized before this. We made the deal, and things are happening differently. This isn't fair. First, I ever heard of those deals. I wasn't there. So I have a sense that the potential of the medium to create legitimacy has not been exploited. And I got to say that, with the honorable exception of Esther Dyson, and Esther's participation has been really special because she gets on the mailing list and she interacts with people, I have been very surprised by how the other major decision makers in this enterprise have been largely invisible in the interactive media. That, I think, has been a major source of the legitimation problem here. People have a sense of decisions being made by the distance, the faceless, but perhaps not listening. And more dialogue would have been helpful, would be helpful. And I should also say that, you know, there's been talk of whether written rules have been continuously adhered to or not. The more that you are participating at a remove, with delay, from far away, maybe not even your own language, the more important it is to adhere to the written rules, or the more that your participation is effectively devalued. So what's the solution? Well, making participation meaningful has been a theme. I'll skip past that slide except to say that it's the right thing to do and it pays for itself in the long run. If the solution, if it's fundamentally a political problem, One possible solution is political. Now, you look at those pictures, and it probably doesn't give you a warm, fuzzy feeling. Right? I mean, but we've got to face the fact that some things are political, and they may end up in that arena. And that is certainly one route where this might go. It doesn't give me that warm, fuzzy feeling either, but it's just a possibility. It might be a technical solution. But because I think these aren't fundamentally technical problems, most of it, at least at the main space problems, most of the IT area, I think that, you know, there's a real discomfort to me in putting all my eggs in a technical basket, because it's not quite like a Sanders debate where you can go off and build a proprietary product and it's better than people will adopt it in the marketplace. When you do things with contracts, the contracts are enforced by legal rules, it's actually much tougher for people to get out and in. Lock-in works differently. But I'm just not sure that analogy is as strong as I wish it were. I'd love to be too wrong about that. There's also, I think, still, we mustn't close our minds to the very strong possibility of internal reform in ITEM that will solve all these problems. I got two models for you. Model one is what I call the retrofit model, or the Bill of Rights model. If ICANN can find a way to make credible commitments not to do some of the things that I talked about at the beginning, the model one kind of problem, in a way that convinces people, I don't think the current board actually wants to do most of those things. But I've got to tell you that the current dispute policies for trademark conflicts with domain names do begin to slide into use. As the trademark law is about misuse of the term, so naturally, the gravitational pull has been to look at how the things are used on the site. So already, in some sense, the camel's nose is not under the tent, it's certainly got right up to it on use. We have the word dilution got into this thing in a 7-week period I wasn't looking. And that's a big change. So big things happen when one's looking. I think ICANN could find some way to make credible commitments to shut down a lot of the root of all evil version one story, and that would take down the pressure. And that's one possible path forward. And as my last point, model two is we do. We learn from this. The United States' original constitution was a document called the Articles of Confederation. It collapsed for all kinds of the same sorts of reasons we're having here, and we came up with something better. So we must at least, open our minds to the possibility that if collapse comes, although it's a shame, to waste, $1 million and lots of work, sometimes good things can come even out of that. I'm not advocating it, I'm just trying to outline the possibility, but now I gotta stop.
How do you do? I'm Milton Mueller. I want to first give you a few words about my provocative title by titling my talk, Why ICANN Failed. I'm not saying that ICANN is dead. ICANN can continue in existence for many years, and it possibly will. When I talk about failure, I'm talking about the inability of ICANN to meet the original goals for which it was created. Now, let me begin by talking about my own personal involvement in this. I just want to make it clear that I'm not somebody who sort of has stood by on the sidelines and carped ICANN. I made comments in the original NTIA proceedings that formed ICANN. I attended two of the International Forum on the White Paper meetings through teleconferences and participating with the Boston Working Group. I was involved in some of the early negotiations about the membership structure of ICANN. I made comments in the WIPO proceedings and testified in them. I helped to form the non-commercial constituency within the DNSO. And up to this moment, I'm participating actively in Working Group C, which is a working group on creating new top-level domains. So when I say ICANN fail, what I mean is I've participated in it, and I've begun to lose hope and faith in the process. Well, let me talk about internet governance, because this is a topic that I think a lot of the technical people here have been leading or avoiding. When I talk about governance, what I mean is the exploitation of technical bottlenecks
or access the technical resources to regulate socioeconomic conduct. Okay? And this is what most of us thought we were avoiding. In fact, to this day, there are still people in the Department of Commerce who will tell you that ICANN is not about Internet governance. And in the white paper, they will tell you that it is not about Internet governance. But in fact, this is not true. There is no question about it now. This is one of the reasons why we have, why I personally have lost faith in ICANN, is that it really is about governance, that it is about grabbing control of the roots and using it in order to regulate conduct. To give you a specific example of what we mean by governance, we can talk about the early history of broadcasting, in which there were conflicts over access to the radio spectrum resource. Now, in order to solve those conflicts, it was, in fact, a purely technical problem. You simply had to coordinate frequencies. You had to decide who got what bandwidth in what area. But what happened to our system of broadcasting regulation? The access to the frequency became, in effect, a public trustee, and the public trustee was imposed obligations and regulations regarding ownership, content, and so on and so forth. Now, Michael gave you a long list of all of the things that could be done by somebody who controlled the route, and then he tried to make an argument that this was not what ICANN was about, that it was all about just chaos, and somehow this big, complicated process and this organization and the problems they've been having with procedure is somehow just an accident. And as a political economist, somebody who studies history and the way things evolve, I'm going to take exactly the opposite perspective. This is no accident. This is a predictable consequence.